This is Katie Dunleavy with My Chronic Illness and Me. As someone who's struggled with chronic illness for more than 15 years, I've often felt incredibly isolated in my journey. Now, as a coach for others dealing with chronic illness, I've realized I'm not alone in feeling that way. There just aren't a lot of forums out there where people can connect about their experiences with chronic illness. So, this is that space, a place where we can educate each other about different illnesses, dispel myths, and, most importantly, share our stories. Let's dive in. Hey everyone! Today I'm talking to Jennifer, who is an artist, a wife, and a mom who lives in Toronto. Jennifer deals with over 25 diagnosed chronic conditions. And as you can imagine with that, there was so incredibly much to talk about with her. I'm actually going to split this episode into two parts. This section of our conversation is about her Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and how it has affected every aspect of her life, from taking way longer to heal from injuries than other people, to the birth of her children, to needing to change her career, and a lot more. So I really hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining me. I'm so happy to meet you.
Thanks for having me. It's really nice to finally meet you too.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? I like to learn a little bit about my guests at the beginning.
Sure. I am a wife and a mother and a daughter and a sister. And that takes up the majority of my time and my energy. I also am an artist and I own my own business. Thank you. Yeah, it's something that I'm sure we'll talk about, because I lost my career and had no future career path and had to start all over again. So that was something that I've done the last few years that has been really hard, really exciting, all at the same time. So being chronically ill affects all of those parts of my life, every single thing. You know, you hear people say things like, don't let it control your life, but it does. If you have chronic illness, you know that it literally controls what I can do, what I can't do, things, times I want to say yes, I want to do things and I can't, times I have to bow out, times I just can't do anything, I can't get out of bed. So it really does affect absolutely everything. And the chronic illness sort of part of my life, it's definitely not all of my life, but that part really does affect all of the other parts.
Yeah, of course. It's like everything in our lives is connected, right? Like our relationships affect our, you know, how we're performing at our jobs, our jobs and what's going on in our careers affect how we feel at home, like our bodies, you know, everything affects everything.
It does.
What kind of art do you do?
So I do something generically called like thick paint. So I paint with paint that is made thick. It's put on in a thick application. The technique I use is called impasto. Impasto painting's been around for a very long time. Van Gogh painted with impasto.
Okay.
Using oils, though. I use acrylic, and I use mediums to thicken the acrylic. So I use a petal shape. Some call it a leaf. Some call it a petal. And using that shape, I paint abstractly. So some of my work is done in florals, sort of an abstract idea of florals. And some is just done specifically just using that shape. If you want, check me out on Instagram. I've got a good following there and lots of people trying to sort of learn this technique. So it is very up and coming. There was pretty much one artist putting it out on social media, and I learned directly from her. So I'm in the first sort of few that have learned this style.
What's your Instagram handle so people can look it up if they want?
It is Grit and Grace Art. It's actually with underscores, but just Grit and Grace Art should pull it up.
Nice. And I'm curious about the petal. So is the petal shape like the thing you are painting with? Is it like a replacement for a brush?
So I paint with a palette knife. It's all done, all of my painting, with a palette knife. And the palette knife, you can paint numerous different ways with a palette knife, but they're all different shapes. And what that can give you when you're doing it in this petal form is all kinds of different shapes of petals, different sizes, widths, stuff like that. Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's really neat. Very contemporary.
Yeah, it sounds really beautiful. I can't wait to check it out. I years ago took several painting classes just as like a fun thing to do that had nothing to do with my work or my pain. And I really loved it. I've been wanting to get back into it. So you're inspiring me.
It is something that I sort of started when I was really, really at my worst. And I actually started with a different style of art, but progressed to this one. I stick with it because it helps my pain, which sounds weird. You know, how can art help pain? But it allows me to be so mindful. I'm in the moment. I am focused on exactly what I'm doing and nothing else. I'm not thinking about what time it is or if I'm hungry or how much I'm hurting. I am just in the moment, in the artistic flow, doing what I love. And that helps distract my brain away from the pain. So it's not that I'm in less pain. Often it causes more pain. But it takes my mind somewhere else, the main focus, for a little while. And I have never found anything else that could do that. Nothing. I've tried mindfulness classes. I've taken full 12-week courses on mindfulness. And it is a very strong tool, but it doesn't work for everyone. And the way I was taught to use it and to do it did not work for me. This does. And I've met several other artists that have said that the same thing. So that's really cool.
It's so cool. I think art is such an important tool for people with chronic pain and chronic conditions, because not only, to your point, does it completely like take up all of your brain energy and space so that, you know, yes, you might still, you are still in pain, but your brain doesn't think about the pain, which is just the ability to turn off that part of your brain that's like constantly in the background nagging, like you're in pain, you're in pain, you're in pain, you're in pain, is such a gift. And then also, you know, like art calms the nervous system. So that's awesome. I'm so glad that you have that tool.
There are so many benefits. It also helps produce dopamine. So there are so many benefits to doing it. I am so happy to have found it. And it is something that I would recommend to absolutely anybody with chronic pain. It, of course, won't work for everyone. There is no thing that will work for everyone. But on the off chance it could, just try. And if that style of art didn't work, try a different style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, cooking is kind of like that. Like when I get really into some kind of cooking project, I like to sort of do not as regularly as I used to, but like I like to do kind of elaborate projects or elaborate recipes, and I'll get just like really into them. And it's kind of like all I think about for the time that I'm doing it. And I love that.
Because it's fast paced and there's problem solving and you have to think as you go. It's very, very similar. I mean, cooking is an artistic form, so very, very similar.
And I don't know about you, but for me too, the element of like being able to take it from beginning to end in a complete life cycle and like control what I am creating is so important from a chronic pain and chronic illness perspective, because like there's so much of my life I haven't been able to control, or, you know, my pain, my illness doesn't have an end point. Right. So like, it's really lovely to be able to be like, no, this is like a finite thing that I'm creating. I have control over it and I can like take it from beginning to end. And then I don't have to ever think about it again.
You're absolutely right. That control aspect that we are missing in so much of our lives is wonderful to have, even in tiny bits.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you comfortable? If you're comfortable, I'd love to have you share a little more about like what kind of chronic pain or conditions you deal with.
Sure. This is going to sound funny. I write it down because I have more than 25 diagnosed chronic illnesses.
Oh my God. And chronic issues.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's a lot. And then when you get to the doctor's office and they get you to write down, you know, all your problems, I can never remember them. I'm like, here's the top five. What's next? So I actually started writing them down. But I have a lot of chronic illnesses and chronic conditions. I guess starting at the beginning, I had always gotten injured quite easily, and it had taken a really long time to heal. I'd been called dramatic my whole life because there's no way it takes that long to heal. You're just milking it, you know, that kind of stuff. Even from people that love you and didn't mean to hurt your feelings, they're, you know, I remember there was this one time I had twisted my ankle, and it was really bad. I was on crutches for 3 weeks, and then we were supposed to travel from, so I live near Toronto, Ontario, and we were supposed to travel to the other side of Canada. So it's like traveling across the States, you know, it's pretty far. And then we were going to go through the Rocky Mountains. And my mother said, no, I'm sorry, you can't bring your crutches. They don't allow crutches on the plane. Good mother move there. And she didn't want to have to carry them the whole time, you know, and I fully understand. But I have a bad ankle the rest of my life because I got off the crutches too soon.
Oh, man.
It's stuff like that. No harm was intended, obviously. And I fully see where she was coming from as a mother. She would be the one who would get stuck carrying them. But we didn't know at that time how bad my injuries were or how long they took to heal. So they take about triple what it takes the average person, usually. I had a surgery done a few years ago, and that was not triple. That was significantly more than triple.
Well, because it's such a traumatic event, that makes sense.
Exactly. And I was expecting triple. You know, on the high end, maybe a little worse, maybe four times. And it was way, way worse. So it was a 7 to 10 day healing time from the surgery. Surgery was done November 2nd. I got the clear July 14th.
Oh, my God. So from 7 to 10 days to like, what even is that? 6, 7 months?
Like, yeah, like 8 months or something.
And oh, then my God.
It took. So then I had chronic pain for another year after that.
Because of the surgery?
From the surgery, yeah.
What's the condition? Is there just one condition or is it a compounding factor of conditions that causes this like really elongated healing process?
So my biggest condition that I would say impacts my life the most is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Okay, yeah. I was wondering if that was what it was. Yeah. Yeah, that's hard.
Yes, is a tough one because it's connective tissue. So it can affect absolutely any connective tissue in your body. So your skin, your blood vessels, your tendons, your muscles, your ligaments, your teeth, your bones, everything can, and any of those things can go wrong at any time. You can be walking and dislocate your kneecap. You can have blood vessels burst. Your skin, you can get skin tearing. It really could be absolutely anything. A lot of people get, go as far as organ rupture, but a lot of them get organ prolapses, mitral valve prolapses. So things like that are all super, super common with a connective tissue disorder. And a connective tissue disorder, it's everywhere in your body.
Yeah. It sounds so unpredictable too. Like, you know, the fact that you said you could just be walking along and dislocate your kneecap, that's kind of terrifying. Like, how do you move through the world when anything like that could happen at any moment?
Right. And then somebody who looks like me, looks like a, you know, young, healthy person, parks in the handicapped parking space. And then, you know, I'm just waiting for somebody to say something. You get a lot of looks. You don't often get somebody saying something, but they do. And how do you react to that? You know, how do you choose to respond? Those things, you now have to be on this heightened sort of feeling at all times in case that happens.
How do you respond when someone says something to you about that?
It depends on the day, on my mood, on how much pain I'm in at the time. if I'm using a mobility aid, it's a lot easier for them to see. So in those cases, you know, I might respond with something that they can see. You know, if I'm using my cane, obviously, look, I have walking issues or something. But you sort of have, you're on edge, which causes a lot of stress internally.
Yeah.
You know, ready to say something. And when you are using mobility aids, people like to ask you what they're for. So I have to wear a neck brace a lot of the time. And then people see me and go, oh, were you in a car accident? Like strangers. No, I wasn't. You know, and then do you want to go into your personal health history with strangers? Or do you just leave it? Do you advocate for the illness? Because the more you talk about the illness, the more people learn about it, the better the understanding and potentially empathy will be.
Sure, but you can't do that for every stranger you meet on the street. Like, you would never do anything else.
No, exactly. Or every time, because it's exhausting. And you're already exhausted, right?
It's funny because, you know, normally I sort of think about the invisibility factor as being so difficult. I have endometriosis, so also an invisible condition. And it's so, you know, I so often hear like, oh, but like, you're so young, you're too young to have that, or like, you look fine. And that's really hard. I've never experienced the, you know, oh, I'll just welcome myself to ask you what is going on with you when I do see a visible factor. It's like there's no winning either way.
No, it's tough. Yikes. It really is. Any of the invisible illnesses, I think, are tough because people can't see them and people don't understand what they can't see, except for cancer. People all know somebody who's had cancer, so they seem to understand that better. But EDS is considered a rare disease at the moment still. There are papers that have come out showing the prevalence is between 1 in 200 and 1 in 500 people. MS is 1 in 750. So they do believe that hypermobile EDS, the type I have, is more prevalent than MS.
Okay.
Which is huge. What they say is, it's not a rare disease, it's just rarely diagnosed. That's sort of the new tagline. And that explains it in a lot of ways. But right now, if you go and Google it, the prevalence of hypermobile EDS will be between 1 in 2,000 and 1 in 5,000, making it a rare disease.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, you're right that it is. I like the description of like, it's not actually rare, it's just rarely diagnosed, and I feel like people don't know very much about it. I actually, a couple years ago, like I think I might have EDS, but I've never been diagnosed, and I definitely don't have it in any near way as severe as what you're talking about. But I definitely have like hypermobility challenges at times. And anyways, a couple years ago when I was looking at my endometriosis symptoms and just trying to figure out, like before I had that diagnosis, just trying to figure out what was going on with me, I found this great article about EDS and I was like, oh my gosh, this resonates so much. I bet it resonates with so many people who just have never, ever, ever even heard of it.
All these things that have happened to you all your life, once you get the diagnosis, suddenly your life makes sense. You were not being overdramatic. You were not being, you know, you weren't milking it. You're not a wimp because you think that a lot. You know, oh, I'm a wimp. Other people don't get hurt this much. Why am I in so much pain? Do I just have no pain tolerance? When usually it's the opposite. Chronic pain sufferers have a much higher tolerance. So, but you told yourself all these things your whole life, and all of a sudden, it all just sort of makes sense. A lot of people ask, why bother getting diagnosed? Because there is no treatment. There's no drugs for it. There is no cure. So why bother getting diagnosed? That's why.
Yeah, that's why. So that you can have peace of mind to be like, oh my gosh, I knew there was something. I feel the same way about really any diagnosis. Like the not knowing is so, it's like soul crushing, like because you're just scrambling around for years, if not sometimes decades, being like, I know there is something going on with me that is not like quote unquote normal. And when you finally have that answer, even if, you know, it's incurable and there's no treatment, like you still, there is still something that like cannot be taken away from you once you have that answer.
The validation.
Yes, that's the perfect word for it.
You know, it really is so important.
So when did you get your EDS diagnosis?
So I am 41. I got diagnosed at 35.
Okay, wow, that's late.
Most EDS diagnoses take, I believe the average is around 9 to 10 years of full-blown problems before you get the diagnosis. It is one that was always harder to diagnose because it's a puzzle illness. So things that EDS sufferers would have: chronic migraines, endometriosis, IBS, kneecap dislocations, shoulder dislocations, you know, like things that you would never put together.
Put together. Yeah.
And that's it. The doctors don't put them together. And then if you get sent to specialists, well, then you see a specialist for your migraines. You see a specialist, a GI specialist for your IBS. You see a gynecologist for endometriosis. You go to all these different specialists, but none of them talk to each other. So nobody's ever looking at it from the whole picture except your GP or you. So if you don't have a GP that is very familiar with it and you've never heard of it, like most people haven't, then it takes a very long time to diagnose. I am very lucky that my GP sits on a board of a charitable foundation for EDS. So she's the medical advisor on this board. And if it wasn't for her and that, I'm sure it would have taken at least another 5 years for me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I think about that all the time with the US health system. Like, it's just so specialized and everybody is so siloed, and you as the patient have to be the one to go and you have to tell the same story like 8,000 times to every different doctor, and you have to take your own documents and your own medical records with you, and heaven forbid you forget to mention, to your point about like having to write your conditions down, God forbid you forget to mention one, and then like that throws, then they get mad at you and it's like, oh my God, like, yeah. And nobody's looking at the whole picture. So it's, I'm sorry to hear that's the same in the Canadian healthcare system.
I think just the way it's structured with specialists, you know, who only specialize in one thing, that you see that a lot. Here, we have a lot more physiotherapy type clinics that have massage therapists, they have chiropractors. So there are several clinics here that work on wellness that have different practitioners, healthcare practitioners, osteopaths, things like that. And I think that, you know, it's not on like the full-blown medical side with specialists and doctors, MDs and stuff, but you are getting healthcare practitioners now working together in these settings. And I think that's a good step forward.
Totally. I think that's started to be a little bit more prevalent here. Like I know, you know, not common for sure, but I know a couple places who think about that too. Like, all right, let's have it be a place where everybody can kind of talk to each other and look at the whole person, which just makes so much sense.
It does. And it helps having different eyes looking at it because they all have different knowledge and different experience, right? So when they're looking at it from like a full point of view, someone might catch something that somebody else doesn't. And that can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, that could change your entire life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm really thankful that I got diagnosed when I did. But if I had got diagnosed earlier, I could have avoided some major physical trauma with the birth of my two children.
Oh, God. Yeah, I didn't even think about that factor. Yes, with EDS.
I'm actually very, very lucky. Things didn't get worse than they did. But if I had had the diagnosis earlier, we would have come at the pregnancy and childbirth from a completely different angle, and it would have changed things and made things a lot better for me. So unfortunately, it didn't work that way. And those things helped me get the diagnosis at least. So, you know, they were valuable experiences that way. But like I had a C-section with my first child because I had a placental abruption with that pregnancy. So placental abruption is quite uncommon. It tends to happen in cocaine users and women well over 40, 45, which I was neither. So didn't see that one coming. But it's when the placenta is attached to the uterine wall and then it pulls away from the uterus. So a full abruption is if it pulls away completely, then the baby only has a few minutes worth of oxygen before the baby dies. Mine pulled away on one side, then it pulled away on the other side, and it stayed attached through the middle. I'm very, very lucky that he managed to get enough nutrients through the placenta and oxygen and everything still that I was on bed rest for 6 months.
Oh my God.
So I was allowed to stand long enough to make myself a quick sandwich. That was what the doctor told me.
and you at this point, like when they put you on bed rest, did they know about the rupture?
When they put me on the bed rest initially, no, they thought it was something else. They thought it was something called vasa previa, because I was having bleeds. So it turned out that the blood clotted and the clot got between the uterine wall and the placenta, and that's what caused it to abrupt. But they thought it was a blood vessel bridging the cervix, which is actually way more dangerous. So I was lucky it wasn't that. But then we went sort of week by week through my entire pregnancy, where it was, is this the week I'm going to be hospitalized? Where my bed rest goes from being at home to being in the hospital. And every week I just barely squeaked out another week and the doctor let me go home. And I followed the instructions and stayed off my feet completely, and which is very hard because it came quite unexpected. Like I was 29, 30 when I got pregnant. So was not expecting that. But we managed to go all the way to almost 39 weeks and deliver with a scheduled C-section.
Wow. I'm very glad that that ended up, you know, happening and that you weren't hospitalized way before that. But geez, what did you do? I mean, I was just thinking, and I don't have kids, so I have not experienced childbirth, but like what do you do with your brain for 6 months in bed rest? Like, what did you do?
Honestly, I don't even remember. And it's that that's the stressful time of your life too, right?
Oh my God. Especially if every week you're like, oh my God, I might have to go to the hospital. I might have to be in the hospital. And like, is my baby okay?
There was an airlift plan in place for me to go from the hospital near me by helicopter to this bigger hospital where my doctor was, because there was only a few hospitals that have a NICU level that high where they can take babies under 29 weeks. So at this hospital, they could take a baby at 21 weeks. 24 is what's considered viability. So below 24, they don't even have a 50% chance of surviving, but they would take them at that point. And being at that hospital I was very fortunate to be there. My doctor was wonderful, but it was a 45 minute to an hour and a half, depending on traffic, drive away. So knowing there was an airlift plan in place, you know, that was great and all, but extremely stressful.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
I was just waiting for the phone to ring, waiting for me to call and say, I have another bleed. I've got to go. I had 9 bleeds and 2 clots throughout my pregnancy. So I was very happy to have made it as far as I did. But during the C-section, people with EDS don't process anesthetic properly.
I didn't
know this, obviously, didn't know what EDS was back then. So the spinal that they give you, it wore off while their hands were inside my body. So they were moving my organs around and sewing me up, and I could feel everything.
Oh God, Jennifer.
It was.
That's awful. That's horrific.
I mean, I've had a couple really, really horrific moments in my life. That would definitely be in the top 5, maybe 3. It was awful. It was awful. As bad as you can, you know, imagine it to be. I'm holding my newborn baby, and like they do skin to skin right after the birth, which was great. And I've just got these tears streaming down my face, and they noticed. I didn't even say anything. And that's when, you know, they took the baby and my husband's like, oh my God, what's going on? And they were trying to figure out what's going on. And even when they figured out that the spinal was wearing off much too soon, they were able to shoot more anesthetic into it to re-numb it, I guess. But after that, you go, after the surgery, you go into recovery and you're supposed to be in recovery for about an hour before they transfer you to your room, where you then recover for a day or two before going home. I was in recovery between 4 to 5 hours. And while I was in recovery, again, the EDS, it caused all of the muscles in my upper body to tighten. They tightened so much that it started crushing my lungs and I couldn't breathe. So my mom was there. She took the baby. My husband's holding my hand. I'm looking at my newborn baby thinking I'm going to die. I'm not going to raise him. Nothing.
Oh my God, Jennifer.
That was worse than the the pain from the anesthetic. That was horrific. Thank God they figured out what was happening and they injected a muscle relaxer into the IV because I still had an IV in. So it went in very quickly and I was able to start breathing again. But it took about 3 minutes before that happened. So for 3 minutes, my oxygenation rate was extremely low. I was barely breathing.
I cannot imagine how terrifying that must have been.
So EDS is a very all-encompassing illness. it definitely would have helped if I knew about the EDS beforehand. But those things helped me get diagnosed because when I got diagnosed through, there's an EDS clinic in one of the hospitals in Toronto, and it just opened in 2017. And I was in about 6 months after they opened. I was lucky that my doctor put in a referral right when they opened first day. And because of all of this history, they were able to look at this history and say, wow, like this is just screaming EDS. So they were able to evaluate these things before even meeting me, which was super helpful in the diagnostic process.
So then, you know, I heard you say earlier there's no real treatment for EDS. I know a couple of like my clients and people I've talked to who have EDS manage it in different ways. How do you manage it?
So it all depends on your symptoms. Whatever the worst symptoms are, that's what you're going to try and manage, right? So for me, the worst symptoms are pain and fatigue. The pain is awful. I get quite a lot of subluxations. So that's a partial dislocation. So the joint, say, take the shoulder, for example. So my shoulder could come right out of the socket and go right back in. What that does is stretches all your ligaments and tendons. And obviously, that's quite painful. Stretches the muscles too. But that causes a fair bit of pain, but it goes away fairly quickly as well. The longer the joint is out of place, so visually this is easier to see than it is to sort of hear explained, but the way your shoulder joint sits, it's like a ball in the socket, right? So your joint can come partially out where the shoulder rolls forward like this. You can almost feel like a little cave behind sort of the ball joint.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It sits partially out of place. So you can get it to go back into place properly. But when it sits out, the longer it sits out, the more it's stretching all of these things, right? So the longer it's out, the worse it hurts.
Yeah.
And I can have things out for days.
Oh, before you notice them?
No.
Or before you can get it back in?
Before I can get it back in.
Oh, okay.
And you can go to the hospital, but they're not great at helping with this illness. They don't understand it. Most people don't even know what it is. I've never been to a hospital where they didn't have to Google it.
Oh my God.
So relying on people to treat you who don't know what it is very, very difficult. And my worst place that comes out is my neck.
Oh God. And that's so risky.
Yes.
To put your neck joint in the hands of people who don't know how to deal with your specific issue. That's exactly. Terrifying.
And most of the time, they refuse to believe that you can even have a subluxation with your neck. They just say that's not possible. You'd be dead.
You're like, cool, but it's happening. Yeah.
I can show you some MRIs and some x-rays. It might help. But if they don't know what it is, you know, you spend hours waiting in a waiting room for them to then tell you, you know nothing about your illness and you're lying to them. That's not possible. So, and to get what? To get pain meds? I have pain meds at home. You know, I have a very good doctor who helps me with staying out of the hospital.
Right.
The only reason to go is to get help relocating something. And most of the time, 98% of the time, it's not worth it. I relocate all joints by myself, even from a full dislocation.
Sorry, if you're comfortable sharing, how do you do that?
So you have this innate feeling when your joint comes out. So if it's a full dislocation, especially, you know exactly what to do. I don't know how to describe it other than in the moment, your body is screaming, push it back, push it back. So if the shoulder comes out forward, using that as an example, my brain will say, push it back. And I will be able to snap it hard enough, usually by myself, that I can get it to go back in. The good thing is it's often easier to relocate than somebody else would be because it has this overabundance of movement to begin with.
Mm. Oh, right.
Sometimes that can help you. I had a full hip dislocation at a family photo shoot in the middle of a garden. That took three of us to relocate my hip. And there's a major blood supply running up your leg. So that was a really dangerous one to relocate. Something like that, I would usually suggest people go to the hospital. But when it's your own body and you've had so many other dislocations, it's telling you how to put it back. It doesn't mean it's without risk. It, of course, is. And if you're having any numbness, tingling, anything like that after relocating a joint, you need to go straight to the hospital because you could be cutting off blood supply. So it is a dangerous thing to relocate it, but it often puts us in a worse place by just going to the hospital. So I will say we generally as EDSers do not like going to the hospital.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. It also sounds, though, like if you are in a situation where you need another person or two other people's help, trying to communicate, like, so I'm hearing you say your body tells you innately what to do, but trying to communicate that to someone else, like, no, like, push it in and up, but with a smooth, like, how, that sounds so difficult.
Yeah, you kind of come across as pretty hostile. Like, you're screaming at them, like, hold me up, you know? Because you're just trying to do this as fast as you can, and you're in some of the worst pain you've ever been in. A hip dislocation is very painful. It's definitely one of the worst ones I've had. And you are trying to explain, for me, it was my husband and my mother, I'm trying to explain to them what to do, you know, without sounding hostile, but you really are.
At that point, sound as hostile as you freaking want to, you know, like it's like a emergency situation.
It's an emergency situation, and you are running this emergency room. You are telling these other doctors, do this. That's what it's like. You know, you watch those ER shows, and that's exactly what it's like. You are yelling at these people, go do this right now. You do this right now. Now you do this. Move this way. And then you just kind of do your thing around what they're doing.
Except that you're also the one in that hypothetical, you're also the one with like the bullet wound or whatever the person came into the ER for. Oh, man.
That's exactly what it's like. So you're trying to think clearly. And sometimes you really are because you get this shot of adrenaline that gets you through it. And that adrenaline really helps you go from being overwhelmed with the pain to thinking. And then you just have to figure out a way to communicate it, which is not easy.
But then also, I mean, I know that it sounds like the fatigue and pain after those episodes would be so awful. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't a lot of people with EDS also have a almost like a rebound effect where because the muscles are stretching or any part of your body, right, is so hypermobile that a lot of the muscles try to like tighten around the mobility to stop the mobility. And so then that actually can injure you worse. Is that, did I get that right?
You have that right. So our muscles try to do the job of the ligaments, which is holding joints in place. Because our ligaments are too lax, there's too much laxity in them to hold the joints in place, the muscles try to take over. That's all we have left to do the job. So the muscles get extremely tight. My muscles pull my ribs right out of place, which is extremely painful. Ribs, because that makes it hard to breathe, hard to move, hard to do anything. So that's because my muscles are so tight, and that I'm on muscle relaxers twice a day to try to stop the muscles from getting too tight. But you're right, that's exactly what they do. And that is one of the biggest things that doctors don't understand. They think you're just supposed to be loosey-goosey all the time, and that's not what it is. Your joints, your ligaments are loose, but your muscles are overcompensating. And in a lot of us, that causes stiffening as you age. So I've had that. And where certain parts of my body are loosey-goosey, they are. Other parts of my body are so tight, it causes so much pain just from the muscle tightness. Forget pulling ribs out of place and things like that. The muscle tightness alone causes so much pain. And there absolutely is a rebound after any type of injury, any type of subluxation, dislocation, anything like that. There is a rebound with the fatigue, with anything. There will be a rebound from this interview. I will probably go down for 2 days, I would say, from doing this, just from the energy it takes to think and talk. That's it. And that will cause a rebound. So I have to prepare for days in advance that I don't accidentally do something that causes me to then not feel well on the day I have to do something. So if I got invited out for coffee, you know, with a friend, I would have to plan that at least a week in advance, where I mentally plan it myself. I don't plan it, you know, in terms of calendar and stuff. That's not what I mean. I mean, mental planning that goes into just doing something. People see you, so me specifically, because I'm on Instagram and TikTok and stuff, I have 25,000 followers on Instagram.
Holy crap. And
yeah, I've got a really, really amazing community there.
That's awesome.
Thank you. And I've got 11,000 on TikTok. So I am very active on social media, but what they see is 30 seconds or something that I filmed 2 weeks ago.
Right. When you had that energy and were like, okay, and I can rest for an hour after that 30 seconds.
Exactly. I pre-film most things. I try to show up on my stories, like I posted right before coming to meet you, you know, and saying just what I was doing tonight and everything. And I did that authentically. Here's me right now, no makeup and exhausted, because I want people to see. They all know I'm chronically ill. I'm quite clear about that. And I want to show what that's like without that being sort of the main focus of the account. I actually have an EDS account as well. So my art account is called Grit and Grace Art. My EDS account is Grit and Grace. No, EDS Grit and Grace. Grit and Grace is my motto. That's sort of like my personal motto. So I try to get through the hard days using grit and determination. Really, it takes a lot of grit to get through chronic pain. I know you know. And grace. The grace is to give yourself grace and be kind to yourself when you are going through all these things. It's also to give others grace who are trying to understand or trying to help, you know, and aren't quite getting it or whatever it is. I think the kindness people show just by trying to understand it, even if they're not fully getting it or they say something kind of stupid or thoughtless or whatever, I try not to get upset about those things. I try to give grace instead, because I think, wow, they're trying. They looked it up. They looked up my illness. They Googled it. That is kind. That is thoughtful, you know? So I try to remember those things, grit and grace.
That's really beautiful. And honestly, I mean, I think as a coach, I work with people all the time to give grace to themselves. I think a lot of people, I would say the majority of people with chronic illness, it's so hard to give yourself grace. But the focus that you just put on giving grace to others is just so generous of you, because you're dealing with so much. And to be able to deal with all of that and then look at somebody else and say, I can see that they're trying, and to make that effort on a consistent basis, that's really astounding.
I think it's important, because we live in a much more aware society now. And I think the younger generations especially are so much more thoughtful than previous generations. You know, if I look at my parents' age or my in-laws' age, my in-laws do not understand my illness at all. Not even a little bit.
Do they cry?
No. No. They are very Eastern European, they're both immigrants to Canada, and very, you know, we had it tough when we grew up, you guys have it so easy sort of mentality. So, and they did have it very tough. I'm definitely not saying that they don't. And see, that's where I think they just see things the way that they have these blinders on to see things through their own personal lens. Whereas I think people in their 30s, 20s, I think I see so much growth with them trying to understand things, trying to learn things. You know, they want to be more cognizant about what others are going through. And I think people can be easily discouraged from going down
that
path,
totally,
or encouraged. And I would much rather encourage than discourage.
Yeah, it's like the difference between like calling somebody out for making a mistake versus calling them in for trying to understand. And it can make all the difference in the world. Like it can really turn someone off if you call them out for something that they don't know or something that they misspoke. And then you kind of lose them to the cause of learning more. Whereas if you are graceful, as you're talking about, and call them in, it's like such a more welcoming atmosphere. So that's awesome. That's amazing that you have that mindset.
It's one little thing that I can do to try and help. And that's kind of how I've always seen my position as an EDSer. I'm neurodivergent. I have ADHD. Really, really interesting. There is a massive connection between neurodivergence and EDS. So yeah, if you look it up, there have been several papers written on it. They are learning more and more every day about the connection between the two. First, it was noticed, first I read anyways, was the connection with autism, actually, with autism and EDS. Then it shifted to ADHD as well. Knowing now that there's a connection with ADHD, autism, hypermobility, you take the hypermobility connection, you can now see if it fits with hypermobile EDS or what's called HSD, hypermobile spectrum disorder. So just knowing that, if we can get practitioners to know that,
those three connections,
then they can help move you toward a possible diagnosis, you know, a possible answer, which is huge.
A while ago, you mentioned, you know, like your parents' generation and your in-laws, you know, not really understanding your conditions. How do you handle people like that who just like do not understand and do not really try to understand?
When it's someone close, like your in-laws, it's very difficult. It is very, very difficult. My mother-in-law is intense and direct, which I do appreciate. I would much rather someone be blunt and direct with me than, you know, talk behind my back or something. Say it to me, say it straight. But the way she views strong and the way I view strong is very different. I view strength as someone who can deal with their shit. Can I say that?
Yeah, of course.
And
you can say whatever you want.
Okay, perfect. Somebody who can deal with their shit, somebody who can own it, somebody who is willing to take the time and do the work of going through it instead of avoiding it. She got cancer, very, very mild, the smallest possible breast cancer there can be. It was removed. She had a, I think, 2 weeks of radiation. That was it. Done. She was depressed for years. I think, and this is just my opinion, obviously, it's because she didn't take the time to work through it. You know, anytime anybody who's been through an illness knows there's up and down, and falling into a depression is completely normal because it's depressing as hell being sick. But she couldn't see to the end. She couldn't see to the other side. She couldn't see the fact that it was gone. It wasn't coming back. It was done, you know? So to me, what I view as strength, being able to own your feelings, your emotions, working through them, taking time to make yourself a better person and do the best you can going with it, right? As opposed to going completely around it and just avoiding it and saying, I'm strong, I did this, it's gone, you know, like it's in the rear view. It's not gone. It's still with you. And the proof of that is often a depression or anxiety or something that stays with people after they go through a traumatic event, because you have to do the work.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because yeah, like if you try to just tamp it down, ignore it, fight against it, not only will that not work, but it often makes it worse, right? Because it's like there's no way out but through. Like you have to, yeah, if you choose not to deal with it, like to your point about motherhood, that's a choice, but it's not going to result in anything helpful. Like the only way to actually start living with what you're dealing with is to talk about, think about, work through,
yes,
all of the emotions it causes. Yeah. I mean, to your point about depression, there's a lot of grief that goes into being sick, having a chronic illness, there's frustration, there's inferiority that you've, there's shame, like there is so much that you have to deal with. And if you just try to tamp it down again, like you can choose to do that, but I've never met anyone who has found that to be a successful strategy.
But something I wanted to say from what you said before. So I feel like in society, we're taught that if you get sick, you fight, right? That's what we do. You get sick, you fight. But the problem with fighting a chronic illness is you're not going to win. Like you said, you cannot win. It is chronic. That is literally...
It doesn't go away.
Condition. And I think we have this built into our heads. Society pushes this into our heads. And you look at something like cancer, you either fight or you die. So there's two answers. You either fight, you know, and you're winning, or you don't with a chronic illness.
People often say, you know, this person lost their fight with cancer when they pass, which, yeah, it's just,
which sucks.
I mean,
they didn't necessarily stop fighting for better, for their future, for their kids, for whatever their personal fight was.
Right. It almost puts the blame on the individual, which sucks, because it's like, that's not what it's about at all.
And you could have been strong the whole time, and they take it away from you when you're dead. I hate that. But I hate the fact that this is drilled into our heads, that that is what success is. You fight and you win. You do not fight a chronic illness. Well, you do. Everybody does in the beginning.
You do, yeah.
And then you lose. And you get your butt kicked. And you realize, and a big, big part of being chronically ill is the acceptance phase. really accepting your illness for what it is, its limitations, and then learning to live within those limitations. I'm a very stubborn person. I am a bit hard-headed. I like to consider myself open-minded, and I'm always learning and trying to do better. But it doesn't mean I necessarily pick things up quickly, like giving yourself grace, which is why I have to remind myself to do it, because you tend to beat yourself up. Why can't I do this? I just want to do this. I should be able to do this. And you beat yourself up because of these ideas society has planted in your head about what success looks like with an illness. And that is not what success looks like with a chronic illness. With chronic illness, my opinion, success is learning how to live your life within its limitations and actually being able to do that, to execute that. Like, I've learned it, but I don't always execute it properly. I overbook myself. I do too many things. I make myself worse sometimes.
And to your point, it's cyclical, right? So like, you can be in a phase of managing and acceptance and executing on what you're talking about. And then, some random thing can happen or not. And just all of a sudden you're like, fuck, this sucks. Then you're back in the sort of like grief and anger phase. And it's a constant process to like assess, okay, like where am I at right now, like in this process? And then how do I want to like envision and live my life based on where I'm at right now?
Yes, that is a really good way to put it. Some people get there a lot quicker than others. I think your personality can really dictate how you deal with parts of chronic illness. And I was very much a type A. I worked in law enforcement. I was always go, 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 busy, full throttle head at all times. And when you can't do that, it's a big change. It's a big change. These chronic illnesses have changed my personality. I've had to change who I am at like a base level for some of these things. I have had to change about myself in order to adapt to the illness.
I was just going to say there's grief in that too. And also there's a lot of power in that as well, right? Like, it's kind of hard to explain sometimes, but there's the, like, you can fight against it. I talk about, my white knuckling phase where I didn't know what was wrong with me. And yes, I tried to figure it out. I went to dozens of doctors but no one could tell me. So what I did is I just freaking got through it. I fought, to your point. I just fought. Every day was a struggle. Every day ended in tears, basically. And so there's almost a taking the power back that can come with like letting go of control and shifting your mindset, whether it's personality, mindset, how you look at the world, whatever, to not only like, for me at least, not only adapt to your illness, but like find joy, like you can still, you're still living a full, beautiful, wonderful life. And it doesn't have to be necessarily a negative, although it's normal to go through feeling like it's a negative.
And periods intermittently of that.
Exactly, exactly. But at the end of the day, if you're able to kind of take your illness as a net neutral, like this just is.
It's just a thing. Yeah.
This just is. And I'm going to live my life in the best way. And I'm going to, adapt these strategies in order to do so. I think that that's the most sort of like integrated version, right, of having a chronic illness.
It's, to me, that's like the acceptance phase. When you take this and you own it and you're like, this is how it is, I'm going to make this work. Look at the value that you can still provide. So maybe I can't go to my son's soccer game, but I can sit and watch a soccer game on TV with him. What is the value? The value is being with him,
spending time with your son, exactly,
bonding, and I can still take that value from missing the game and put it somewhere else and still get, you know, the time with him and the bonding and the closeness and all that. It's just different. But when you can own it, that's where the power is. I totally agree.
Yeah. You're making me think when I was kind of at my low point, I worked with a health coach, which is why I became a health coach eventually, because she just helped me so much. At one point, she asked me, like, you know, what does success mean to you? And I was like, oh, that's easy. It's like, you know, getting promoted and being, you know, successful at my career and blah, blah, blah. And she was like, well, would it be possible for success to mean being a good partner, being a good daughter, being a good sister? And I was like, no. Like, I was like, those things are critically important to me. Like, those are like the core of who I am as a person, but that is not success.
But that's not your
definition. And we had this whole process of like shifting that. And now I'm like, yeah, hell yeah. Like, that is me giving to society. That is me like having some kind of impact on the world. And so it just reminded me of, you know, your point of just shifting. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And the way that you think about, you know, what is success and what is happiness? How do I show up in the world? What is my value? You know, I know you're not in law enforcement anymore, but you provide these amazing pieces of art for the world. And like, no, I'm not, you know, making hundreds of thousands of dollars for nonprofits anymore, but like, I'm helping people like deal with their illnesses. You know, like, it's just, there can be value in so many different things.
There can be. And I think, you know, part of hustle culture, right? Like, society pushes this on you that you work, 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 work. You know, you get promoted, you get a better job, you keep going up, you move up the ladder, all these things, you know, you're constantly, that's what success is. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to get promoted. I'm going to make more money. I'm going to buy a big house. I'm going to, you know, do all these things, right? And when you get sick, I think you really see where true value is. And I think a lot of the times it's maybe not necessarily where we thought it was. You know, I went through a very difficult time when I realized my career was over. I was medically retired out of my job. I was on long-term disability. And then I went into medical retirement. I didn't really have a say. So yeah. I had a hard time with that. Again, I had no control. It was my illness dictating it. And here I had worked, I'd gone to college for this. I'd worked my butt off to get this career. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to help people. And now I had nothing. I didn't go straight into an art career, which I never, ever would have believed if you told me anyways. But I didn't go straight into that. I didn't go into anything. I had nothing. And when you go from this career that is part of you to nothing, you feel like then you're worth nothing. And it's not true. It's not true at all. And you need to work through that and get to the other side where you see how much value you have just as a person and where true success for you lies. You know, for me, it's being a good mother, because that's what I'm putting out into the world is my children. So I want to raise kind humans. That's what I want to do. That's what
my value is. That seems extremely valuable to me.
I think so too. And I think, you know, I'm happy to be a parent that is trying to do that. You know, anytime that you're doing that, I think that is trying to help people. That is trying to make the world a better place, you know? No, I'm not trying to keep illegal drugs or illegal firearms out of the country or something. That's what I did before I was in customs. But I am still trying to have an impact on things however I can.
Yeah. Well, and I would, if it's all right, I would just reframe that a little to say, you're not still trying. You are having an impact.
I think once you do that reframing, there's a lot of power in that. And that's what takes time. And that's why you have to take the time to work through these things. Because if you don't, you miss that part of owning it and taking the power back, you know? I never thought I would have another career because I can't work. I can't work a traditional job. I can't work any kind of job. We rescheduled this interview like 10 times.
Well, not only because of you, because of me too. I mean, that's what we were talking, we were laughing about. Like, it's just a thing. Like, if you're in the chronic illness world, how can you possibly be mad at someone for needing to reschedule? Because you yourself undoubtedly have had to do that to people, cancel last minute, you know, whatever. Just, hey, I'm in bed. I can't get out of bed right now. Sorry. You're going to have to deal with it, right? Like, how, I don't know. It's so funny to me because people always mention like, oh, it's so nice to like, you know, just be able to reschedule. And I'm like, literally, I have done that to people 1,000 times. I would be so hypocritical if I wasn't okay with people needing to do that. I just want to say thank you for taking the time to really talk with me because I know how much you're giving to do that.
Thank you. You know, nobody ever acknowledges that. And that really makes you feel seen when someone does. So thank you. Because it does take a lot. But I always want to be helping. That's just like my nature, right? I want to make a difference. I want to help. I want more people to know about EDS. I want to advocate about it. I want to scream it from the rooftop some of the times, you know? I want people to understand how complex this illness is. Truthfully, every day is different with EDS, but just if somebody is at their worst now, it will change. It will. There is light at the end of the tunnel. I know how horrible it can get, but it's going to change. It doesn't mean it's going to be better, necessarily cured or something like that, but there will be days where, you know, what you're dealing with now, you're not dealing with anymore, right?
Like, it's like that cycle that we were talking about again, which in a way, you know, you can really choose how to look at that, right? Like it could be it could be something that you dread if you're feeling like relatively okay to know that, well, it's going to change and I'll probably feel worse at some point. But on the other hand, if you're feeling terrible, it can be hopeful and helpful sometimes to know that it will not last forever, like exactly what you're experiencing right now.
There's a really common thing I'm sure you know of called spiraling, that when you're at your worst or you're at a really bad point, you just spiral out of control in your mind, you know, like this is never going to end. This is what my life looks like. How am I going to deal with this forever? What the, you know, like, how do I get through this? And you will, and you can. It's not going to be what you thought. It's not going to be what you expected, but there will be better days. There will be. There absolutely will be. You will still be able to do some things you want, just not all of them. So you need to learn how to prioritize in a way you didn't have to before. But, you know, I always think everybody's got something. Everybody's got something. And learning as much as you can about it can teach you how to deal with it to the best of your ability, which is really, really helpful.
Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. It was really, really lovely to talk with you. And I really appreciate you taking the time to explain some of the many things that you're dealing with and be so passionate about sharing your experience and your knowledge with others in the hopes of helping people. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for doing this, for having this podcast and trying to help people and trying to help people with a range of different things. I really admire you because I know how much work that takes to put into that. Just trying to run that EDS Instagram account took so much of my time and so much effort when you're dealing with chronic fatigue and you don't have a lot of spoons or a lot of energy to put into something, and then you pour all of yourself into this, I can see. I really admire you for doing that and want to thank you as a chronic illness person, because you and people like you out there are helping so many people without ever being able to see the results of it. You are helping people. If you, you know, don't know that, I'm so happy I get to be the one to tell you, you are. there are people listening and you are helping them and you are making a difference with what you're doing. So thank you for letting me be just a little part of that.
Thank you so much. I really, really, really appreciate that. Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed my first part of my conversation with Jennifer. As I said at the beginning, there was so much that we ended up talking about. So coming soon, there will be a second portion of our conversation. But I wanted to say from this part, you know, Jennifer's motto of grit and grace really moved and inspired me. And I hope you take the time to go check out her art and her EDS Instagram account. Both are Grit and Grace. One is Grit and Grace Art, and the other is EDS Grit and Grace. If you're interested in learning more about me or coaching, you can find me at reviveandthrivecoach.com. You can always email me at katie@reviveandthrivecoach.com or find me on Instagram at reviveandthrivecoaching. All right, I can't wait to see you next time.